I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Eileen Pollack, author of the fine new novel, The Professor of Immortality, based in part on the Unabomber case. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Passover's over, the oddest Pesach ever, perhaps, and while the great festival of freedom has receded into our rearview mirrors, a few reflections are in order on the first Zoom-centered Chag HaMatzot, well, in history. You know, there are so many traditions associated with our springtime holiday of Pesach that in the aftermath, we mostly just want things to return to normal. You eat matzah and avoid all leavening for a week. You invite lots of guests into your home, make all kinds of special foods, ritual and regular. And if you keep kosher for Passover, you spend the week trying to figure out just how to feed the people in your home without exhausting everyone with leftovers from Seder or some variation of kugel and matzah brei. On Passover, for kosher-keeping Jews, there is no takeout, no quick order of pizza, no fast pasta-centered meal to whip up. Food becomes a kind of obsession, and the lack of various bread and pastry products can turn you into a gluten-free person against your own will. All of which makes Pesach a peculiar week. We are all usually glad to get back to normal after Passover, gorging on the bread, pizza, croissants, donuts, scones, and pasta we've been denied for the past, 7 or 8 days. We put the Passover plates and cookware back in the garage, refill our shelves with chametz and life, or at least eating returns to normal. Of course, this year there is no getting back to normal after Passover. In this season of lockdowns, quarantines, social distancing, and isolation, of layoffs and furloughs and unemployment, temporary and otherwise, of wild seesaws in the stock markets and crazy gyrations at the highest levels of government, of a constant flow of deeply weird and often bad news from all around the globe, it's easy to think that this is the new normal. We've gone from believing this will only last a few days or a couple of weeks to canceling and postponing events that are months away, hoping things will substantially resolve by, mid-May, or June, or at worst, July. And locked into our homes with those closest to us, we endeavor to find ways to refresh those relationships and to occupy our minds and hearts and hands. Well, I have a suggestion in that area. Now that Passover's over, we're in the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Pesach, the Festival of Freedom, and Shavuot, the Holiday of Covenant and Torah. For the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, we take a few moments every evening to say a blessing and count the days that lead us towards a reaffirmation of our Brit, our covenant with God certified at Mount Sinai. As the passage in Proverbs says, teach us to number our days so that we may make each day count. The counting of the Omer reminds us that we have the capacity to make every single day matter, to bring holiness into our lives daily. This simple ritual is a reminder that wherever we are, and no matter what restrictions we operate under, we have the ability to bring sanctity into our lives. So, what if each night now you take a few moments to count the Omer, to count each day, so that every day may count? I'm not saying it'll guarantee that we are back to some kind of normal by Shavuot, but who knows? At the least, it brings the possibility of transforming days of frustration and disappointment into something sacred. Tonight, at or after sunset, we'll count the 11th day of the Omer, 1 week and 4 days towards the 50th day, Shavuot, the day of the receiving of Torah. I'll chant the blessing this morning so you can hear it. May it herald the coming of a better time of health, openness, and joy.
Baruch Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher kitshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivonu al svirat haomer.
That was the blessing for the counting of the Omer, which brings us closer, we pray, to covenant and freedom and health every day. You know, my friends, I have often suggested that if we burn chametz just before we start Passover, we should therefore burn leftover matzah after Passover. But this idea has never caught on, sadly. Instead, play us in this morning, in her now classic song, past two Jewish guest Michelle Citrin tells you 20 things you can do with matzah after Passover is over.
What am I going to do with all this matzah?
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah big and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
Insulate.
Decorate.
Nine. Exfoliate.
Ten.
Constipate.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah dog house for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye. Or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzah jewelry. Make a picture frame for me. Have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
That was Michelle Citrin's 20 Things to Do with Matzah After Passover's Over. If you have other ways, please let me know. Email me at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Got to figure it out before I find myself looking at two or three leftover boxes when I'm cleaning for Passover next year. You know, like I did this year. When we return in a moment on 2 Jewish this morning, our guest Eileen Pollack will tell us what the Unabomber, a unique terrorist of the 80s and 90s, had to do with her new novel. Find out when we come back in a moment on 2 Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring, all by virtual availability. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus tsaris, join us Friday night on Facebook, our Facebook page, for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson, and we'll hold services with full music by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, which you can access by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall. We're not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. But for now, you can reach us from anywhere as a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for more information. You can also attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, also on Zoom, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation and High School programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, all also on Zoom. And, of course, our services on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing congregation in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Author Eileen Pollack is the author of a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction, including, by the way, The Bible of Dirty Jokes and The Rabbi in the Attic. We're not going to talk about those so much, but her new book, The Professor of Immortality. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Happy to be here, Rabbi.
So, Eileen, this is a fascinating premise. First of all, in your book, the professor is a professor of immortality. That's, you know, literal description. That's sort of her job. But the second is it's about the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, more or less. Tell us how you decided to write this book.
Well, when I moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan in the mid-90s to teach in the creative writing program at the university, it turned out that one of our graduate students had been working for a psychology professor, and he had actually received one of the exploding packages that the Unabomber had sent. So right away, there was a connection, you know, where all my colleagues really hated the Unabomber for having hurt someone they really cared about. I mean, he survived, but he was hurt. And then a little while later, after I got there, it actually came out that Ted Kaczynski was the Unabomber and that he had been a student in Michigan for quite a few years. He got his doctorate in math there. And when his identity was revealed, one of his professors, not a math professor, he took a different course, said, oh, my goodness, Ted was one of my very best students, the only one I ever gave an A+ to. I really liked him. And as a professor, that set me thinking because I had had so many sort of very brilliant but angry young white male students. And I thought, what if I began to suspect that the Unabomber was one of my former students, somebody I really cared about? Would I turn him in? Would I feel responsible? And so that's basically where the idea came from.
So tell us about coming back to that, the profession of the professor and what she studies. Tell us how that came about.
Well, you know, my undergraduate degree was in physics.
From a little school called Yale. Yeah. So
So I've always been very interested in technology and the future, you know, what the future might bring. And so when I read the manifesto, it's about all the bad things that the future might bring, you know, and Kaczynski wasn't wrong. He was sort of prophetic about, you know, in the 90s, writing about what technology was going to do in terms of global warming, but destroying the planet and the cost of that. But unlike Kaczynski, I also love what the future might bring. And I just think that there's a profession called being a futurist. But almost all the futurists are straight white men. And I was really interested in, you know, who's designing the future that all the rest of us are going to live in? And I have to say, that's sort of where my Jewish roots come from, too. The character I give her, a father who is this brilliant man who didn't get much of an education, but he's kind of an inventor in upstate New York, in the Catskills, where I grew up. And, he's there in the Adirondacks next door. But he keeps talking to her when she's a little girl about, you know, the age of the Messiah and how it's up to us to bring it about. And so I'm just so curious. You know, I grew up semi-Orthodox, you know, repeating the prayer every day, you know, that this time will come when all the iniquities will be removed. And, you know, I guess I've always just wondered what that future would look like. And now that people are predicting, people like Ray Kurzweil, you know, that this point right. will come when we'll live forever, you know, really? What's it yeah. to be like? And what effect would that have on religion, art, literature, and just everything about our family lives? So I was fascinated, and I wanted my futurist to be a middle-aged woman who, with an elderly parent and a son she loves, and kind of bringing a different
viewpoint, a different understanding. Yeah. We will talk much more with Eileen Pollack about her book, which has just come out, and also about her extensive career when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, there's a section of the morning liturgy, it's called the Yotzer, in which we thank God for creating the natural world. Probably the most famous part of that is you renew the work of creation every day, B'chol Yom Tamid. But it's actually based on a passage in Isaiah in which it says, we bless God, Yotzer ata tov uvorei ata ra. God who forms good and creates evil. And, you know, in Judaism we say there's a blessing for everything, but that's a tough thing to say, particularly right now in this challenging time. What are your thoughts? Like, let's reflect on that a little bit.
Well, I have a couple different thoughts. First, I think that it's a fundamental tenet of Judaism that God is the sole creator. So everything in the universe, whether good or bad, whether sickness or health, whether happiness or grief, is actually created by the one and only God. So, I mean, then maybe there's a question of, well, why did he have to create the bad as well as the good? Why did he have to create suffering and illness and plagues and pandemics and whatever? And that is something that people more philosophically inclined than I am have struggled with over the centuries, I think, and have concluded that it's important for us as Jews to acknowledge God as the source of everything and not to be Pollyanna-ish about the world. There is evil, there's hatred, there's racism, there's violence, there's sickness, but maybe acknowledging that together in a minyan also helps us confront that together as a community. And I think there's also an important kind of reflection on the Jewish notion of free will and how nothing is predetermined. So you can choose to do bad. God created that choice and that possibility.
In fact, that's the definition of free will, is the ability to do wrong. I mean, if everybody automatically did everything good, there's no free
right.
will.
And there's the notion of the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer HaRa, the good inclination and the evil inclination. And somewhere in Jewish history, philosophy, liturgy, etc., there's an explicit acknowledgement that we all have both an evil inclination and a good inclination, and that the chief task or challenge of our lives really is to maximize the Yetzer HaTov, the positive inclination to do good, which we can never do all the time and exclusively, and to minimize the inclination to do wrong or evil, that's the Yetzer Hara, but also an acknowledgement that just as we can never do 100% good, we also can't eliminate 100% the Yetzer Hara. It's always going to be there. It's part of us as individuals. It's part of the community. It's part of the world.
And, you know, that helps explain why human beings don't always act well. I want to come back next week and talk a little bit about, as you mentioned, you know, there are aspects of this that don't have anything to do with us, right? The, you know, the circulation of illness, natural disasters that we reflect, you know, why does God allow that to be part of the fabric of creation? In the meantime, we'll all maximize our Yetzer Tov and limit our Yetzer Hara. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective. To be frank, in this time of pandemic and widespread growing unemployment, it's difficult to even sense that there is a presidential contest being waged now. While President Trump seems to be making every public effort to avoid responsibility for the extremely uneven and erratic response of his administration to the threat of coronavirus, and to take personal credit for any positive effort made by the same government, former Vice President Joe Biden has now received endorsements from all his former opponents for the Democratic nomination. Last week, Bernie Sanders, the great socialist hope and only Jewish candidate in history to win multiple presidential primaries, or any primaries for that matter, Bernie Sanders formally endorsed Biden for president. Under more normal circumstances, and just what is normal this year, Bernie Sanders' formal endorsement of Joe Biden during Pesach would have been the first item on the news on every web service, social media platform, and TV news show. This year, it has fallen somewhere between the president's assault on the World Health Organization, his latest threats about forcibly recessing the U.S. Congress and Senate to force through his political appointments, and trumpeting his non-existent constitutional authority to force states to reopen the economy, while the very real threat of COVID-19 remains. Well, we live in very strange times. Like many of you, I long for a return to some sort of healthy normalcy at all levels. That was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An elderly gentleman goes into a barber's shop. There's no waiting. The barber says, "Come on, sit down, Mr. Stein. How you doing? Tell me, what's new?" Stein says, "Well, next week I'm going to celebrate my 60th anniversary." The barber says, "My goodness, Mr. Stein, that's wonderful. What an accomplishment. How did you do it?" And Stein says, "I'll tell you, when we were married 30 years, I took my wife Sylvia to Jerusalem." The barber says, "That's it? That's the secret? You took her to Jerusalem?" And Stein says, "You didn't let me finish. Next week, I'm going to pick her up." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, and don't forget to pick her up, or him. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Tazria Metzora in the book of Leviticus, and a wholly unappetizing set of portions it is indeed. Metzora in particular focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease in the ancient world, but mostly an archaic and pretty disgusting section today. It is true that leprosy was an awful thing and needed to be eliminated, if at all possible, in particular, by using the concept of, wait for it, quarantines to isolate people. But exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length on a Shabbat service, especially these days, can scarcely be called a spiritually meaningful experience. The rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem long ago. They came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word metzorah, which means leprosy, was itself, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew motzi shem ra, which means slander, or evil or wicked speech. There's a legal concept in American jurisprudence called the fruit of the poisoned tree, which rules out the use of evidence collected illegally. That is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted, not legally admissible. So it would be with Mitzorah and all other forms of Lashon Hara, evil speech. Whether the gossip has elements of truth in it or not, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupt source. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, the awful tendency to speak ill of others. Commit no slander, and your own life can be clean of this moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that damage others, we can find our way clear to living better, holier lives. In the portion this week, it even delineates forms of Mitzorah that affect the very houses in which we live. It's called Mitzorah at Bayit. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of the property, it may even need to be destroyed. It's a little along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And so, if we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations, synagogues, and communities in which holiness can really flourish, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated. May we each do our part, now and always, to remove Mitzorah, personal impurities of speech, from our own lives. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, author Eileen Pollack, tells us how she, a professor, chose to write her new novel revolving around the Unabomber, who started as a professor too, by the way. We'll find out their association when we come back on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin informed Benny Gantz that his mandate to form a government had ended, and he has transferred the task of forming a government to the Knesset overall. Gantz, head of the Blue and White Party, Kahol Lavan, and now Speaker of the Knesset, had been tapped to form a coalition government after the March 2nd election, Israel's third in under a year. Last weekend, Rivlin said that in the current circumstances, he would not grant Gantz a two-week extension. Usually this is a formality to form a government. Rivlin then extended the deadline by another 2 days after a joint request from Gantz and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said they were close to an agreement. But negotiators for Netanyahu and Gantz met past midnight Wednesday night and failed to finalize a deal. Maybe the problem was that it was Yontif. Well, anyway. Lawmakers now have 21 days to select one of their colleagues to form a government if he or she gets 61 votes in the Knesset. This means Gantz and Netanyahu still could form a working coalition during that time. I hope that the Knesset members will be able to form a majority in such a way the government can be formed as soon as possible, preventing a fourth round of elections, Rivlin said in a letter to Gantz informing him of his decision. If it occurs, that would be the fourth national election in Israel in just over a year. You can have too much democracy. Gantz's blue and white coalition fell apart over his decision to negotiate with Netanyahu. Gantz promised during the last election back in March that he would not share power with Netanyahu. And the day after Rivlin's declaration, Netanyahu called Gantz, inviting him to meet again to discuss forming an emergency unity government. And the beat goes on and on. A Massachusetts man was arrested and charged with attempted arson at a Jewish assisted living facility there. John Rathburn, 36, was charged in a criminal complaint in federal court in Springfield, Massachusetts. The facility, Ruth's House, is located in Longmeadow, a suburb of Springfield in western Massachusetts, situated within a mile of other Jewish facilities, including three synagogues, a Jewish private day school, and a Jewish community center. The facility is owned by JGS Life Care, which has had 32 residents so far die of coronavirus in its elder care units. The homemade bomb was discovered April 2nd, made of a 5-gallon plastic gas canister filled with flammable liquid with burnt paper, later identified as a Christian religious pamphlet placed in the nozzle of the canister. Part of the pamphlet was charred after being lit on fire in an attempt to ignite the gas. Bloodstains found on the paper, boy, this guy's not smart, matched Rathburn's DNA. Rathburn's DNA profile is known to law enforcement. He is a previously convicted felon, according to a report. The report said he will be released on bail. If convicted, Rathburn faces up to 10 years in prison. The criminal complaint noted that in March 2020, a white supremacist organization operating on two social media platforms was identified by law enforcement with posts that promoted mass killings in the U.S. and elsewhere, directed against religious, racial, and ethnic minorities. It discussed the use of various explosive and incendiary devices. It identified synagogues and mosques as targets. In times of national crisis, hatred based on religion often blossoms into violence, said U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling. Yeesh. Further evidence of that came when a synagogue in Huntsville, Alabama, was vandalized on the first night of Pesach with neo-Nazi graffiti. Among the graffiti spray-painted, sometime on Erev Pesach, on the Eitz Chaim Synagogue, conservative shul of about 60 families in South Huntsville, were F the Kikes, Gas Em All, White Power, Jew Scum, and Holohoax. Several swastikas and the lightning bolt symbol of the Nazi SS also were spray-painted on the building and the property. No service has been held in the building in recent weeks because of the coronavirus crisis, of course. Police are reviewing security camera footage, but since it was raining when it happened, it's not easy to identify the perpetrators. The city of Huntsville condemns anti-Semitism in the strongest possible terms, said Mayor Tommy Battle. As a city and as an inclusive community, we stand side by side with our Jewish brothers and sisters and peoples of all faiths. Any offense against one is an offense against all. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. Welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Aileen Pollack's new book is called The Professor of Immortality. She grew up in Liberty, New York, which is where I used to get off the shuttle to go to Grossinger's, as I recall, or the Concord, one of those places in what used to be the Jewish Catskills, whatever it is now. She's a graduate of Yale with a bachelor's in physics, who later earned an MFA from the renowned writing program at the University of Iowa. She is the author of a number of novels. It's amazing that I haven't interviewed you before, since you write such Jewish stuff, have received a number of awards for Jewish writing, Rabbi in the Attic and Other Stories, The Bible of Dirty Jokes. Well, I'm not sure The Bible of Dirty Jokes was a title, but it's got Bible in there, so it should have.
Yeah, it's The Bible of Dirty Jokes. That's right.
That's right. One of her books has been made into a film, and, you know, just a real extraordinary writing career. So in creating The Professor of Immortality, and you're dealing with such a complicated question, you know, basically a serial murderer, right? In terms of, that's a tough subject. You somehow managed to humanize it and make it understandable. Was that a weird thing to do?
It was, because, you know, on the one hand, I didn't want to say at all that I was condoning what Kaczynski did. As I said, you know, the student that he had severely injured was just before my time, but, you know, he was still around campus, and I didn't want to shortchange the horrors of terrorism. On the other hand, as I said, you know, if you read the manifesto, it's hard to disagree with most of it, although I don't think the answer is for all of us to go back to living some kind of sustenance, you know, life in the woods. But as I said, I had so many students like Kaczynski, and if you read his journals, his letters, his papers, if you read about his biography, it's very hard not to empathize with him in many ways. He was deeply, deeply lonely, and loneliness is something that interests me. You know, here on the one hand, people are saying, oh, we have the technology to live forever, and people are designing all these latest gizmos to do this, that, and the other thing, and we haven't even, you know, found a cure for the essential human loneliness that makes so many people so deeply unhappy. And Kaczynski, you know, it's an oversimplification to say he wanted a girlfriend, you know, but he wanted someone to love him. And it literally drove him mad. At one point, he even contemplated changing his, lying to the doctors that he was transgender so he could change his sex to female so he could put his own arms around himself. Yeah. And then a woman would be holding him. And I just, you know, now we call guys like him incels, and there's, you know, people say, well, it's their own fault, it's not our obligation, and straight white men, you know, we don't, you know, pity them for anything anymore. But I just find all those questions really fascinating. I don't have any answers, but I wanted to explore that, you know, that psychology. And again, the main character, he's off stage almost the whole time, you know, so the main character is my heroine Maxine, and more her relationship with her son,
right, Zach,
who, you know, again, it's part of his Jewish heritage, although he says that being sort of a socialist is more the way he's Jewish. He wants to help everybody almost to an excessive degree, and I'm trying to find the line between how you raise a son who's so good-hearted and manages to do good in the world without going off the deep end and becoming, like, you know, a radical terrorist, and somebody like Kaczynski who really did go off the deep end.
You know, I want to go back to the son, the relationship with Zach, who goes off and commits acts of social justice. He runs away to do that. Very Jewish thing to do, actually. Who's he modeled on?
Well, I'm not going to say my own son.
I thought you might. That's really why I asked. It's a
I know.
Tricky
I
interviewer only, question there, but go
I
ahead.
Know. I will only say that I have the most good-hearted son in the world, and that when he was going to be bar mitzvahed, he started reading Marx, and he didn't want to go through with it. And I said, no, you have to go through. He has his great-grandfather, my grandfather, was a Jewish socialist on the Lower East Side, and my son's very proud of that, and he says...
That's
well,
okay. My grandparents, my mom's parents were socialists, but in New Jersey. So, but go ahead. Anyway, never mind.
So, you know, so he said that's my way of being Jewish, but, you know, but I was kind of, when he was very young, a little bit scared, you know, where's the line between somebody who's good-hearted and someone who, you know, does good things in the world versus... You know, somebody on the, you know, it used to be the left in the 60s that was so radical that, you know, slipped over into the, you know, the weather underground. And I think having grown up in the 60s, I was always fascinated by, yeah, we want to end the war, but and solve racial injustice and stop all these horrible things from going on. But, you know, where's the balance? So with Kaczynski, I was really interested if he was sort of saying in the 90s, look, the technology, the industrialization, the things we're doing to the earth are going to kill millions of people and wipe out millions of species. And so his calculus was that it was worth killing a few, you know, people like, you know, oil industry executives or something to make the point and prevent that from happening. And, you know, I can't, you know, once you talk about hurting people, you lose me. But on the other hand, you also lose me when you're talking about us killing, you know, causing the deaths of millions of people and wiping out all these species. So, what do you do?
How do you effectuate
radical?
Right. How do you effectuate change if you're too gentle? Also,
right.
You teach writing a great deal. You've been doing it for a while. What's the most important thing for a writer, in your view?
To really learn to write your truth and not what you think you should say, not what other people want you to say, not what you think might sell, but trying to get at an account of your true experience. And I say that what I tell people, whether I'm teaching fiction or nonfiction, is what are your real questions about the world? Not the questions you think you should have, but what are the questions that really trip you up minute to minute, day to day, year to year in your life? And most people have been brought up to think that any question they think of couldn't be a good question because they're not authorities, or if it was a good question, someone else would have asked it or answered it already. And that's never true. You know, we all have questions that flit through our minds or that obsess us. And so I try to get people to grapple with those questions. Some of them are funny, profane, you know, profound, whatever. And you know, I like to think I've gotten a lot of people to write some really meaningful stories, essays, novels. you know, my grandparents owned a hotel in the Catskills.
Right, that was called Pollock's Hotel. Yeah.
And in the same town as Grossinger's. And so I've also been fascinated by humor, you know, stand-up comedy.
Well, and the Bible of Dirty Jokes, of course, that's what it's about to a large degree. So, okay, so go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, so I mean, I'm making all this sound so serious, but people tell me even when I'm writing serious, my work has elements of humor in it. And so I didn't want people to think this was all very grim.
Well, I don't know. The Unabomber discovery of immortality. It sounds very light and cheery, but actually it's a fun read. What was the most surprising thing? I tend to ask this question, but what was the most surprising thing in writing The Professor of Immortality?
That's a good question. Well, originally... And this often happens when people write novels. You think you can end it too soon. So, you know, it's sort of a thriller. At the beginning, the main character starts to suspect that her former student was the Unabomber, and she doesn't know what to do about it. And she's afraid that her son, who was friends with that particular student when he was on campus, anyway, her son, as the novel is beginning, her son has actually disappeared. She hasn't talked to him in 6 months. So she's afraid to turn in the student that she suspects is the Unabomber because A, she might be wrong, and B, her son might be involved, and she doesn't want to get either of them in trouble or killed before she knows for sure.
Right.
So it's kind of a race to figure out what's going on before another victim gets killed. And I honestly just didn't know what she was going to do. And I kind of had, in the original conception of the book, it was all going to end off screen on the evening news.
Right.
A friend read an early version and said, no, that's really not going to be very satisfying. So my trying to figure out the novel actually goes to Montana at the end. And I actually didn't know what was going to happen when Maxine and her son, if her son was involved in the Unabomber, what happened when they all met up. And so that was the biggest surprise, is I had to figure all that out.
So I have to say, I appreciate the fact that you did, because so many books don't seem to figure, they haven't figured out how to end in recent, I don't know, decades even. you know, you read a great book, you go, oh, this is fantastic. You get about halfway through, then you get two-thirds of the way through, then you're like, they don't know where they're going, do they? I'm not probably the only person to make that observation about contemporary novels. How do you avoid that pitfall?
Well, you know, I think that somehow literary writers decided that plot was a commercial, gimmick. And so a lot of my students are afraid of plot, and I just always loved plot. And honestly, I think it does go back to growing up in the Catskills, because things were just all larger than life, and the craziest stuff went on. I mean, I was trying to get at that in The Bible of Dirty Jokes, because it's not only about humor in the Catskills, but about Murder Incorporated and the tie between the Catskills and Jewish organized crime.
Yeah, which there was significant ties.
Oh, very significant. And, you know, I grew up with, we'd pass a lake and my father would say, oh, let me tell you about all the bodies that they dredged up from that lake. And, you know, serial murderers, serial killings going on, you know, in Liberty while I was growing up. And so,
oh my goodness,
I think nothing seemed too outrageous to me. And so I'm not afraid of sort of having a lot of plot. And if you have a plot, you have to end it. You have to figure out, you know.
Even if it ends in the bottom of a lake, you know, you got to end
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. do you think of yourself as a Jewish writer? I mean, obviously you're Jewish with a strong Jewish background, and there's a lot of Jewish themes. Do you think of yourself as a Jewish writer?
No writer likes to get pigeonholed. So, you know, somebody says, are you a woman writer? Are you a Jewish writer? Science writer? You know, you usually don't want to be limited that way. On the other hand, if something's so deep in your essence, it's just silly to say, oh, no, I'm not. You know, being a woman doesn't really affect what I write, or being Jewish, it doesn't affect it. I mean, literally, if you grow up at a hotel in the Catskills, you know, sort of semi-Orthodox, going to Hebrew school every day. It's silly to think that's not going to influence you. What's interesting, though, I think about my work is that if you pick up certain books, it's clear they're written with a Jewish intent. And other books, you pick them up and you're like, okay, well, in this one, she's trying to write about science, or, you know, the one that got made into the movie is about a white woman who lived with Sitting Bull. That's not fiction. But, you know, so I have all these different parts of me. I studied physics for 4 years, and I faced a lot of obstacles as a woman.
And you're still a pretty normal person, even after studying physics for 4 years.
Well, it took a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. I know a lot of physicists. My brother-in-law's a physicist. They're not normal people normally. He is, well, more or less. But anyway,
they can be pretty wonderful too.
Indeed, absolutely.
All these mysteries, but,
absolutely.
So I'd like to say I have all these different facets, but you know, even the book that's about the white woman that lived with Sitting Bull and was his sort of lobbyist, and she was an artist, she was a remarkable woman. She wasn't Jewish, but I felt as if she was Jewish. I kept picturing Barbara Streisand playing the role. There was something about being an outsider and being that kind of, you know, the person with the social consciousness who recognizes what the other is going through. And, you know, so even when it's not there, I think it really informs what I'm writing.
I want to thank Eileen Pollack for a wonderful visit here on Too Jewish. The new book is called The Professor of Immortality. Where can people go to find out more about you, more about your books?
My website is EileenPollack.com, and the book is for sale wherever you can buy books now that so many stores are closed, but there's...
Online delivery exists.
It does. So, yeah, it's been lovely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein, head of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. Our playout this morning comes from, well, the section after the counting of the Omer, Sheyabona Beis Hamikdash, Cantor Moshe Stern, and the IDF Orchestra and Chorus, May the Temple Be Rebuilt, a classic composition. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, and a week in the counting of the Omer that we pray is of peace.
Oh! הפרק שיבנה בית המקדש, לפרק לא יישא גוי אל גוי חרב. ואל הבמה עלו חברי מקהילת הרבנות הצבאית בניצוח רב סרן משה מונה רוזנבלום, שאף הלחין קטע זה, והסולן הוא החזן הצבאי הראשי, סגן אלוף אריה בראו.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.